Well, I've been interested in the natural world since I was a small boy, and members of my family showed me about plants. They taught me how to name flowers and trees and birds. And my father was interested in the stars and took me out and showed me constellations. So I think probably that started me off. And then this was encouraged later by school teachers who took an interest in me. I went to school in a small grammar school in West Yorkshire. And then when I was about 17, I decided that I wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge. I could have gone to London University or several northern universities. But I set my sights on Oxford or Cambridge. And eventually, I ended up studying chemistry at Oxford. Whilst I was there, I developed an interest, which was latent anyway, in biology. And so I became interested in applying chemistry to biological problems. And so when the time came for me to study for a PhD, or DPhil as it was called at Oxford University, I wanted to do something that was linked to biological sciences. And so instead of working in the chemistry department, I went to work in the pathology school in Oxford. I worked there with a man who became Sir Edward Abraham, and he'd been one of the discoverers, not one of the discoverers, but he'd helped to put penicillin on the map during the Second World War, and he discovered other antibiotics that eventually made him a large fortune. And so I worked on peptide antibiotics. And then when I graduated in 1969, I went off to the United States for 2 years, continued those studies, and then in 1971 I had the opportunity to go to France with a fellowship because I wanted to learn about a technique called mass spectrometry. And then eventually in 1974 I came to Cambridge to a workshop whilst I was still working at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. I met Frederick Sanger, and he asked me, had I thought about coming back to England? And I did. And 6 weeks later, I was working in his laboratory. So it was really this chance meeting with Fred Sanger that eventually brought me to Cambridge and the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology. And there, in this very famous institute, which had multiple Nobel Prize winners, I stayed until 1997, when I received the Nobel Prize in chemistry. And at that point, the Medical Research Council asked me to become director of what was the MRC Dunn Human Nutrition Unit. And so that happened, and I moved to my current premises. And in 2008, the MRC decided that it would be appropriate to rename the unit the MRC Mitochondrial Biology Unit. And so that happened. And then I continued as director until 2012. So in the end, I was director for almost 15 years. And now I'm still here in the same unit, and the MRC have recently decided to support me for another 5 years research. So in order to work, biology needs energy, and that energy has to come from somewhere, and biological energy almost entirely comes from the sun. And it's absorbed by a process called photosynthesis by green plants. They make high-energy compounds. We eat those compounds in the form of carbohydrates and sugars and fats, and then we break them down and take the energy in there and convert it into something that you want me to talk about in a moment called proton motive force, which I'll explain. So this process is rather like burning. And in fact, that's what it is. It's burning in our bodies in a controlled manner. And that burning, or oxidation, as it's called in chemistry, consumes oxygen. In fact, it consumes almost the oxygen that we breathe in. And it breaks down the high-energy compounds and stores the energy in the form of potential energy, rather like collecting water in a dam that can then be used. The water has energy, it can be released through turbines, and those turbines generate electricity. So it's something rather similar that happens in the mitochondria. So the mitochondria are the powerhouses, the power stations, where these, say, energy-converting events take place. So we're converting energy in food into energy in another form, and that is known as the proton motive force. This concept was developed by a Nobel laureate, an Englishman called Peter Mitchell, and the idea is very simple, that the oxidation, the burning of sugars and fats leads to the transfer of hydrogen ions. Those are charged hydrogen atoms that have lost their single electron. They're called hydrogen ions. They have a positive charge. And the burning of sugars and fats leads to them being pumped out of the mitochondria to the outside. And when you do that, you've moved a charge, and what you've done is to generate voltage. So effectively, what we've done is to convert the energy in sugars, in carbohydrates and fats, into a voltage. And then that voltage can be used to drive a machine. And that's what happens, because in the inner membranes of mitochondria, there's a machine that I've studied. It's called the ATP synthase. What it then does is to generate a molecule called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. And this is the energy currency of biology. So the energy in sugars and foods is turned into a voltage. The voltage is then used to do a piece of chemistry to generate the molecule ATP. And the ATP is the energy package that's delivered to the cell and is associated with all kinds of processes in biology. Replicating DNA, making DNA, making proteins, and so on and so forth. Making your muscles move, it's required for thought processes. So without ATP, we couldn't do anything. Without the ATP synthase, the machine, we wouldn't exist. So one of the interesting things about mitochondria is, where did they come from? And what we think is that way, way back in biological evolution, the first cells were very simple. But then later on, what happened was they swallowed another cell, and that cell was the precursor of the mitochondria. Originally, the swallowed organism had its own independent functions, but it lost them and became dependent for most of its functions on the cell that had swallowed it. But left behind was the equipment for making ATP. So there was a mutual dependence. The swallowed organism made all the energy, and the other one was dependent upon it for its energy. And that's the situation in almost all the cells that from which we're made, apart from red blood cells. All of them contain mitochondria. All of them depend upon the mitochondria to produce energy in order that they can work. So the ATP synthase is embedded in the inner membrane of mitochondria. So mitochondria have two membranes, one inside the other. And the ATP synthesizing machine that's driven by the voltage is embedded in the inner membrane. And the astonishing thing about it is it has a rotary mechanism. And so the voltage is used to drive a rotor. And the turning of the rotor then carries out chemistry in another part of the machine. And this chemistry is the formation of ATP. And when we first described this idea, it was novel in terms of having an enzyme, that is to say, a catalyst, a biological catalyst, that had a rotary action. There is another machine, and it was known already in nature with a rotary action. And this is the motor that drives the flagellum in simple bacteria. They move around by rotating their flagellum. Some of them can rotate it in either direction. Other organisms can only rotate it in one direction. And when they rotate it in a counterclockwise manner, this drives them forward, and they swim forwards, and they'll swim towards a source of food. If the rotation is reversed, then the organisms tumble, and then eventually it will switch back again and they'll swim forward. That motility of bacteria is also driven by a rotary machine, and it's also driven by this voltage, the proton motive force. And so we suspect, we don't yet know, we suspect that there will be some evolutionary relic in both machines which will indicate that they had a common origin. It seems unlikely that such a complex mechanism would evolve twice, but that can't be ruled out. So from 1974, when I arrived in Cambridge onwards, I was working alongside Frederick Sanger, and he was a Nobel laureate in chemistry some 20 years earlier. And he was at that time developing methods for determining the sequence of DNA. And this method was used eventually in the late 1990s to sequence the human genome. But I was there right at the beginning when he was developing these methods. And what I was doing was to help interpret the meaning of the sequences that he was determining. So the first one was in a small virus from a bacterium. And then he decided to sequence the DNA that's found inside mitochondria. I've not mentioned that, but most of the DNA in the cell is in the nucleus, but there's a tiny little bit that's in the mitochondrion. And it has interesting properties, because unlike the DNA in the nucleus, which is a mixture of DNA from both parents, the DNA in the mitochondrion comes exclusively from the mother. And so any diseases associated with that particular, arising from mutations in that particular little bit of DNA, they will be transmitted through the mothers, through the female line, not through the male line. It's an interesting point which hasn't been fully explained yet. But anyway, he wanted to sequence the DNA in human mitochondria. And so I helped by making the human mitochondria from placentas that I got from the maternity home here in Cambridge. And again, my task was to try and contribute to understanding the content, what the genome, the mitochondrial genome, meant. And this got me interested in the respiratory enzymes, because some of the genes that are found in the mitochondria are genes for components of the respiratory enzymes, the enzymes that are converting the energy in foodstuffs and burning those compounds by consuming oxygen. Those are the respiratory enzymes, and they generate the proton motive force, this voltage across the inner membrane. And so I became interested in these enzymes, these complex assemblies, and I read extensively about them and became most interested in the enzyme that makes ATP. And so about 1980 or thereabouts, I decided to start studying it. And at that time, it was rather a daunting task. It seemed it was clearly a large structure. It was bound in the membrane, which has associated difficulties, and it was clearly complicated. And some people were discouraging. They said that I was unlikely to make progress. I should find something simpler. But I decided to persist, and eventually it all came good in the early 1990s, when we began to see now where all the atoms were, and we began to understand for the first time how this machine worked. And it was from this analysis that the idea of a rotary enzyme came, and this was proved quite rapidly by Japanese scientists, who were able to visualize the rotation directly in a microscope, putting beyond doubt that this enzyme worked by a rotary mechanism. Because when I suggested it, there were many people who doubted it, and they told me so. but the Japanese experiments put this beyond doubt. So the Japanese experiments depended upon our structure, and they couldn't have done the experiments without the knowledge of the work that we'd done. So one followed directly from the other. I just wanted to know how this thing worked, and the only way that I knew of doing this was really to just analyze what it was made of, to work out what the component parts were, put it back together, and then look at it and see whether we could work out how it functioned. So it's a bit like looking at a detailed plan of a motor car engine and then trying to work out how the motor car engine works. Up to 1997, it had taken 17 years, and I'd had working with me throughout that period about 10 other people, and we were all working on this particular topic for most of the time. I did one or two other things along the way, but that was mostly what we were doing. And so it really was a huge effort to get to that particular point. The story's still not ending. I'm still working on it, and there are still features that I don't understand, and we've recently made a lot of progress towards getting a more complete understanding, but the story's not over yet. Remember, I was surrounded by very distinguished people, and several of whom had won Nobel Prizes, and some of whom won Nobel Prizes later. None of them was really very encouraging. The most encouraging was Sanger, who merely said, "Get on with it," and that was all he said. Perutz told me that it would be a life sentence. Of course, he was completely correct about that. And Milstein told me that enzymes are boring. He later, when he realized I'd done something significant, he became extremely interested in what I'd done. Now, that seems like a rather unsupportive environment, but on the other side of the coin, they let me get on with what I wanted to do, and I had all the financial support and support for resources that I could possibly have wished for. So in that respect, I was very well supported by the Medical Research Council and by the Laboratory of Molecular Biology. So in October 1997, it was announced that I was to share the Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Paul Boyer and Jens Sku. We'd all worked on ATPases in different ways, and so there was a link between our achievements and the Nobel Committee in Chemistry decided to recognize what we had done, and that was a huge thrill. There was huge interest, and people were very excited by it. They could see that it was a major breakthrough in this field, and in fact people outside the field could also appreciate that it was something really very significant that we'd done. They appreciated how hard it had been, and that it was a kind of tour de force, and we'd really advanced this field significantly, but also it had a wider effect on other fields as well. So I think there was a general appreciation of what had been achieved. It's immediately relevant to this field of energy conversion in biology because it explains one of the major steps. But it also eventually became apparent that it was relevant to other biological processes insofar as it now turns out that there are other molecular machines involved in a wide range of processes that in some respects are related to the way the ATP synthesizing machine works. And so what we had done gave insights into fields that were apparently unconnected, and people were able to take advantage of that information. People had started hinting that this might happen to me. Generally speaking, I just asked them to go away because I didn't want to engage in conversations of that type. But in October 1997, when the prize was announced, of course it was hugely thrilling, and really was one of the high points in my life, and was really just so wonderful to feel so appreciated and to belong to this very exclusive band of scientists, and I felt really quite humbled by it. And then, of course, once the prize is announced, then you get taken up by the events. Of course, people are thrilled. They want to interview you, talk to you. And then, of course, on December 10th comes the award ceremony in Stockholm, which is an absolutely stupendous affair, and with lots of banquets and parties, as well as the award ceremony itself. And then that's followed by, of course, what seemed like endless invitations to give lectures in Scandinavia, in Europe, and around the world. So I would say for at least a year, my life was not my own, really. I was running around all over the place. But it was a unique experience. I certainly enjoyed it, and I tried to make the most of it. And I was lucky, really, that, again, I'd had so many colleagues that had won Nobel Prizes, and two of them did advise me on how to deal with what they knew how it was about to happen to me. And I did find that counselling, as it were, quite helpful. Well, I mean, the Nobel Prize has all kinds of impact upon you. It definitely opens doors. You end up meeting people both in science and in wider society that you probably would not have met otherwise. But I don't think it changed the research, because I already had very good support, financial support for my research. I had very good people who came and worked for me. Of course, once I had the prize, there were more people who wanted to come and work with me. But in some respects, it had a negative effect, because it diverted me from doing research. I don't resent that at all. I was able to put my time to good use and actually to pay something back, because I felt that was one of the things I wanted to do. I'd had, as it were, a pretty easy ride up to getting the Nobel Prize, insofar as I'd not really done much administration, and I had been in a somewhat privileged position in being able to pursue research for most of my time, and I felt that becoming director and building up this unit was a way of paying back to the Medical Research Council and to the wider scientific community. And so I was really quite conscious of doing that. Well, it certainly had a big impact on me once I became director, because being director means you have wider responsibilities. You have the responsibility of finding other independent scientists to join you in your institute, to build it up, to build their careers, as well as trying to continue with your own research, and also this additional expectations that came from me to behave as a Nobel laureate. So it was difficult to continue with my research all the time. There were many other things that diverted me, and building up the DUN and what eventually became the MBU was a very large part of my life. And so I was very gratified when the Medical Research Council recognized, or its reviewers recognized, that we had built something of international significance. And that was the situation when I stepped down 2 years ago. Well, the other enzyme that interested me hugely in mitochondria is known as complex 1. It's part of this respiratory chain, and it's one of the three enzymes that helps generate the voltage from the energy that's coming from burning foodstuffs. What was very clear was that it was even more complicated than the ATPase, and very little was known about it. And so in the late 1980s, as a kind of break from working on ATPase, I decided to define the protein composition of complex 1, and so with half a dozen or so colleagues, we did that, and we found it was made of eventually 44 different proteins arranged in an L-shaped structure, and so this gave the first glimpse of how complicated this thing was. And that was the point pretty much I got to in 1997 when I became director of the Dunn, as it then was. And so what I did was to appoint two younger people to work on this problem. I decided that I wouldn't work on it any longer. I'd concentrate on ATPase. And so this gave them both a big head start over other people. And my faith in them was justified when in the last 2 or 3 years they have independently arrived at an atomic level structure of the bacterial form of complex 1, and more recently the other person, Judy Hurst, has begun to get at the structure of the enzyme found in the mitochondria, the one with 44 different proteins. And so it was very nice to see the hard work that we put in from in the early 1990s now being converted into real understanding, although there's still more to be understood, but at least the proper molecular deep understanding of how this other very complicated machine is working. So the study of metformin in mitochondria was taken up by my colleague Judy Hurst, who I mentioned a moment ago, in the context of complex 1. And it was known that one of the effects of metformin was to affect the activity of complex 1. So she studied that and published it recently. But she also found out that metformin also has an effect on the ATPase complex. It actually inhibits it and stops it from making ATP, although, at least in my terms, it's a rather weak inhibitor, much weaker than the ones that we study. So at the moment, we need to repeat some of her experiments for ourselves. So at the moment, I'm not sure about the biological significance of what she's found on the ATPase complex. I think what she's found on complex 1 is the impact is much clearer. Now, whether this will translate into some deeper understanding and development of newer drugs based on metformin, time will tell. I mean, the general point about metformin is that it has an influence on glucose metabolism, and what people are really trying to find out is at what levels that influence is exercised, and one of the places it acts is in the mitochondrion, and at the moment we don't have a clear picture, I think, of what the precise molecular pharmacological effect is. Well, when I got the Nobel Prize, in some respect I was unsatisfied personally, because I knew there was much more that could be done to get a deeper understanding. So although we at that time understood the effects of rotation, actually we didn't properly understand how rotation was generated. And so that's what I've concentrated on. And we are actually very close now to getting a proper molecular description of that process. So how the voltage drives the rotor and exactly what is being driven. So we didn't know the structure of that parts of the motor, and we're very close to that now. It's been technically extremely difficult thing to do. But along the way, something else has happened, and that is, it turns out that something that was completely unforeseen is that there is associated with the ATP synthase complex in mitochondria, there is another activity, which actually is a general mechanism of regulating it, I think. And so in the mitochondria, the machines are not found singly, but they're found two together. There's two stuck together. And they're arranged in long rows. And in the middle of contact between the monomeric machines, there is a channel. And this channel, if it's opened, causes the contents, the mitochondria, to rush out, and then water rushes in. And what happens then is that the mitochondria swell and they explode. And this leads to the death of the cell. There are two mechanisms of cell death, and they both involve the mitochondrion. On the one hand, there's apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And on the other hand, there's necrosis. And what I've just described is the process of necrosis. And we're trying to understand this mechanism and how exactly what the channel is in structural terms, and how it opens, and how to stimulate its opening with drugs, and also how to prevent its opening with drugs, because that would have a big effect in a number of areas of medicine. So this is something that's just happened in the last couple of years. We've made tremendous progress. When you came through the door, I was actually writing the paper because we want to communicate this as soon as possible. And it's hugely exciting. And it's really given a new lease of life to our research. And it's this topic that forms the nucleus of the program grant, the 5-year program grant that the MRC have just awarded me. That's £2.1 million for the next 5 years. And I was able to convince them about the importance from a fundamental and medical point of view of knowing more about this channel. And they recognized that probably I was in a better position than anybody else to do something about it. So I'm very excited about this.